This webcast is a service of SDPB. Good, useful, and full of wonder. SDPB.
You may be seated.
Thank you.
The next case up for argument is in the matter of the interests of IQ et al., appeal number 31318. Bo Bluin is present, will be arguing on behalf of appellant mother, SQ. Jeremy Lippert, Special Assistant Attorney General, is present, will be arguing on behalf of the state. And Tiffany Landine will be arguing on behalf of Appalachian Children. I understand you're going to divide your time up, Mr. Lippert and Ms. Landine. 10, Mr. Lippert, and 5 for Ms. Landine. All right, Mr. Bluin, you may proceed with your initial argument.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Bo Bluin, attorney with South Dakota Office of Indigent Legal Services, and I represent the appellant mother. This appeal challenges the circuit court's denial of the Sisseton, Wahpeton, Oyate tribes' motion to transfer jurisdiction under the Indian Child Welfare Act. The circuit court found good cause to deny the transfer to the tribe based on the advanced stage of the proceedings in the best interest of the children. In doing so, it applied an improper legal standard. It relied on considerations prohibited under ICWA, and it exceeded its permissible discretion.
When you make that argument, Mr. Bluin, are you relying upon the 25 CFR Part 23, Subpart 1 regulations, or are you relying upon policy and purpose statements contained in the Federal Register? Because I don't think those are binding. Or the 2016 BIA guidelines, which by their terms, like the predecessor 1979 and 2015 guidelines, are also not binding. So, to me, we're dealing with 25 CFR 23.118, the text of that, which we've agreed, you know, and in a pre-Loper-Bright case, we said those are binding. But I see the arguments is drifting over into these policy and purpose statements or these ICWA guidelines, which to my mind are not binding.
No, I'm essentially relying on the 2016 regulations. I'm referring to the preamble to the final rule as guidance in interpreting those.
I agree, and that's how I read it too. Those, however, in my view, are not binding. They are not encapsulated in final rulemaking. They were part of the final rulemaking policy and purpose statement in the Federal Register, but they don't appear in the Code of Federal Regulations as binding regulations.
I agree with you on that note. But I'm also going off of this court's ruling in CRW where the court does refer to those guidelines and does refer to the advanced stage of the proceedings and what that means.
Makes a difference on that, doesn't it? Because C1 of 118, 23118, seems to count the advanced stage or calculate the advanced stage maybe differently than the guidelines or some of the guidance might suggest. And you mentioned that in your brief.
Yeah, and I do believe that the regulations require the courts to consider, when they're looking at the advanced stage analysis, to look at not only these notice requirements. The notice requirements, they're required at the outset of both proceedings, the foster care proceeding and the termination proceeding. And in the preamble, you know, it does explain that, you know, the rule is implemented to ensure the rights of the parents and the tribes are protected so that if they are not given that required notice, that they aren't punished or not alleged to have been late in their notice.
But C1 doesn't say that. And Judge Howman in her decision said there's no rule. I know you might disagree with that. She says there's no legal rule that says we have to re-notify or there has to be some new resetting of the clock after there's notice of an intent to terminate. And when I read C1, it says the judge can't consider in making this good cause determination whether the foster care termination of parental rights proceeding, so that's the bigger proceeding, and that's defined, it's just defined in the federal regulations, is at an advanced stage if the Indian child's parent, Indian custodian, or the tribe did not receive notice of the child custody proceeding until an advanced stage. So the child custody proceeding, and I understand there are proceedings within the proceeding, but the child custody proceeding is the A&N case. The termination of parental rights proceeding may be a proceeding within that, but the way they calculate advanced stage is with reference to notice of the larger A&N case itself. At least by the text it is. I think the guidance says something different.
Well, and I would again point the court back to CRW, where this court did explain that the advanced stage is calculated by each individual stage. And the court in that case looked at the time the petition to terminate was filed to when the motion to transfer was, the motion to transfer was filed and the petition to terminate. They looked at the difference there, not the entire range of the child custody proceedings as a whole. And certainly, my reading of 23.118, it doesn't say the child custody proceedings, plural. It's referring to the proceeding, whether that's the foster care proceeding or the termination proceeding. They are two individual proceedings. And I believe this court in CRW also explained that each proceeding ends in an order. And so the initiation of each separate proceeding it's initiated by the petitions, whether that's the petition alleging abuse and neglect at the very beginning of the case or the termination of parental rights. And I would note in this case, I think there are very good reasons that a tribe in these types of cases do not file a motion to transfer because they may believe that the best chance for reunification is having the case remain in state court at that time. It may make sense to them, but their calculus changes once they see termination is on the table, and that's why the notice of that proceeding is so important.
So you would read that the tribe did not receive notice of the child custody proceeding to be the termination parental rights proceeding, even though the text doesn't say that, and the text uses termination of parental rights at an earlier point in that subsection.
Well, I think it's 23.111 talks about notice being required at each proceeding. And so the tribe must receive notice of that proceeding. And in this case, the tribe filed the motion to transfer before the state had given any indication that they had an intent to terminate parental rights.
So C1, though, doesn't say the tribe did not receive notice of the termination of parental rights proceeding. It says did not receive notice of the child custody proceeding, which is a larger proceeding when you look at the definition of it.
Sure, but I think child custody proceeding is describing whether that's the foster care proceeding or the termination proceeding. I think the regulation would have stated the proceedings if it meant the entirety of the case. And I think the regulations taken as a whole, when you look at the notice requirements for each stage and the reasons for that.
And so maybe there's some, I don't know, you want to say ambiguities maybe some things you can read into some of these regs. The state makes the argument that under Loper-Bright, the analysis has changed even for state courts. Do you disagree with that?
I believe that the regulations as they are still binding as law. I agree that the preamble to the final rule is not binding. But
I mean, in terms of if we're these guidelines that we have that the BIA has put out, they're helpful. They're things we can consider, but those are just guidelines. And even the regs, to the extent that there's not clarity in those regs, we can read those consistent the way that we think they should be read, particularly under Loper-Bright. Would you disagree with that?
No, and I agree that I think this court in CRW agreed with what the guidelines, the 2016 guidelines, found that they were consistent, the regulations were consistent, and even said the court should look at the advanced stage of the proceeding within each individual proceeding. So here, the tribe was, they stayed, they tracked the trajectory of this case. They may not have intervened or filed a motion to transfer right away. They paid for mother's treatment. They remained in contact with maternal grandmother. They reached out to DSS in March to ask for updates. Their understanding is that mother was getting out of prison in May 21. And then there was a June hearing. She's doing great. The tribal agent learns in July that mother has been arrested on charges. And that same month, she contacts DSS to indicate the tribe's intent to transfer the case. And so we see in this case that the tribe is doing its due diligence and giving notice. And so I think that accounts for something in terms of they are being proactive and they're doing what they need to get the case transferred. It wasn't...
Judge Howman made a finding. Forgive me for interrupting. Yeah. Judge Howman made a finding, as you undoubtedly know, and she found that on February 27th, 2025, well before all of this stuff, I mushed that, so February 27th, 2025, the state filed its amended summons with the court. The amended summons references that termination of parental rights is a possible remedy of these proceedings. And if you look at the 23.2 definition of a child custody proceeding, it is a child custody proceeding that could result in and culminate in any one of these things, foster care, termination of rights. It seems like she's making a finding that this child care, this child custody proceeding could result in a termination of rights, and this is back in February of 2005. If you set that back and you don't get into August, September, and some of those time frames, the stage looks more advanced, doesn't it?
Well, if we're going to look at it from that perspective, then it would be further along.
I'm just trying to apply the rules.
Doesn't every notice that that is sent out indicate that termination is an option?
They do. And I think everyone knows whenever there are abuse and neglect proceedings, that's a possibility. But
if that's the case, then it fits squarely within the regulation, which says a child custody proceeding means any action other than an emergency proceeding that may culminate in one of the following outcomes, and one of the outcomes is termination of parental rights. So if the proceeding that's being initiated says, by its terms, this could culminate in the termination of parental rights, that is a child custody proceeding that could culminate in rights, and why doesn't that begin the proceeding against which we would measure the advanced, relative advanced point of it?
I think it goes against the spirit and intent of ICWA in general that, you know...
Now we're back to the non-binding regulations.
Well, no, and I think... By that reading of that definition, it could be interpreted that way, but I don't, when we read the guidelines on what notice is required and why it's why you have to give that notice, and then you look at tribes filing a motion to transfer right when they have that notice that termination is on the table, I don't think the law says that tribes are being negligent in their filing of the motion.
I don't think that's her finding at all. I think she said it was an advanced stage. I don't think she's ascribing negligence or any sort of culpability to the tribes whatsoever. Judge Howman, that is.
But the advanced stage does refer to the stage within the individual proceeding.
I agree with you on
that. And this court has said that. And so I think you have to look within the termination stage to see if it's there that it is at an advanced stage. And the state hadn't even... made its intention known that it was seeking termination at this point.
But that's not the point. The text is it may culminate in one of the following outcomes.
Sure.
It may not, but it may culminate.
From the time they give the 48-hour notice, the 48-hour hearing notice indicates this proceeding might result in termination. So under the argument that Justice Salter's making, the time for advanced proceedings would start running from the very first day.
I suppose that could be true, but I think in this court, even in CRW, did not measure that when it looked at the advanced stage of the proceedings and when it measured the time from the petition of the termination of parental rights to when the motion was filed. And I think that's the proper way to apply this rule.
Go ahead.
Well, I think we might be mushing together two things. So we have the rule which says when you cannot consider advanced stage, and I think that's the one that you've been asking questions about. So if we were to determine the tribe it wasn't a scenario where they didn't receive notice of the child custody proceeding until advanced stage. So therefore, it's not a prohibited determination. So we can consider it. But then we still, in that context, then we can look at things like, okay, but was this an advanced stage of this particular proceeding in terms that it would result in a basis to deny transfer?
Right.
So you can still look at your point then. So now we look at, all right, well, is this an advanced stage of the termination part of the proceeding?
That's correct, and I believe that does fall under 23.118. I do see that in my time.
Yeah, and I want to ask you some questions about best interests, so we'll do that in rebuttal.
Sounds good.
Mr. Lippert.
May it please the court and counsel. Good morning. My name is Jeremy Lippert, attorney for the Department of Social Services and representing the state of South Dakota in this matter. I think the case on appeal turns most heavily on the standard of review for this court and whether we can say that the circuit court abused its discretion in finding that good cause existed to deny transfer. The briefing and the discussion so far have talked a lot about the advanced stage analysis conducted by the circuit court in this matter. I would note that there are other grounds that the circuit court found that were good cause, also constitute good cause to deny transfer to the tribe. So we've talked about the ICWA regulations. Good cause cannot be predicated on timeliness of motion transfer at an advanced stage unless notice was provided to the tribe before the proceeding reached an advanced stage. And that on that front, I would point out the circuit court's findings that the case had long reached the dispositional phase. There were many notices that had gone to the tribe respecting the possibility of termination of parental rights as an outcome.
So I just want to stop. Yes. So at least and I'm kind of going back to, and I know this, I just made the point, this federal rule is referring to what you can't consider, but it doesn't refer to dispositional phase. It refers to foster care or termination of parental rights proceedings. So is there a difference between, because not every dispositional phase, sometimes there isn't even a contemplation of termination, things work out well. And then it's the ones where it doesn't, then you end up with, okay, now we're at the point that we're gonna request termination. So is there a difference between that?
I think the point in raising the dispositional phase is that the case has progressed. The case has progressed along the road toward resolution. Resolution is required, as the circuit court noted, by approximately 12 months. I don't think that always happens, but that's the objective.
But the progression isn't always forward. It moves back and forth.
Right.
So the tribe looking at it might be assessing it differently. Things are going well. We don't need to intervene. Now things have advanced to termination. Now we need to request transfer.
I think that given the facts in this case, it is fair to say that the parties involved had every reason to believe that termination was going to be likely, and that, as Circuit Court noted, discussion of transfer began sometime in July, around the same time that the appellant was arrested on serious charges. And yet there was still some delay in requesting a transfer.
But the standard would have to be an objective one, right? It wouldn't be actual knowledge, from a comment here or there at a hearing or whatever. 118C1, and then the definition in 13.2 or whatever, Those are keying in on notice, and that's a particular, of course, objective measure of when we can start thinking about advance, or at least navigate around the prohibition against considering an advanced stage.
Well, and I think that the circuit court here found that the tribe had actual notice, whatever any defects of a formal notice may have been.
Do you think there were defects in formal notice?
I do not.
Okay.
It's an analysis the circuit court undertook.
So the state's kind of flipped in its position in this case. It seems like in front of the trial court, the state didn't object to transfer, didn't make an argument that good cause didn't exist. Now I hear the state making a different argument. Talk about that.
Thank you. It's a good question, Your Honor. I would distinguish these in saying the state did not take a position on transfer at the hearing, and this is not necessarily a question as to the relative wisdom of transfer. Rather, the state is asking this court to grant the deference that's suggested under the abuse of discretion standard to the circuit court, effectively defending the circuit court's findings. The circuit court has made its decision, and at this point we're now approximately a year, slightly less than a year further along in the case, and so the state's interest is in securing the best interest of children and placement stability for them. So I wouldn't say that the state has flipped its position on that matter.
So what I'm trying to understand is, you know, if you just read the statute, ICWA, with respect to transfer, you know, unless there's an objection by parents or a declination by the tribe, the standard is in the absence of good cause, correct?
I believe that's correct.
And so then the regulations that were promulgated, they're essentially are telling the judge what not to consider. They don't say what good cause is, but they say what good cause is not. Do you believe those regulations, in light of Loper Bright, are still binding?
I think that the state's point in raising Loper Bright is to, I think the mother, the appellant, urges a very strict and candidly very guidelines-based approach to interpreting the ICWA regulations. And I don't think it's necessary in light of Loper Bright and in light of South Dakota precedent on this issue. I would note that we've been talking about advanced stage, and we have precedent in a South Dakota case, AO, where the determination about whether a petition to transfer is timely is made on a case-by-case basis, which I think necessarily suggests a certain amount of discretion on the circuit court's part. A fact-based investigation analysis, which I think...
And that's the whole point behind Loper Bright, right, is that the judge ought to make the decision, because that's what judges do, to determine whether or not good cause exists or absence of good cause exists. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, I misunderstood the question.
Well, if I read Loper Bright correctly, I mean, the whole point of it is that you don't get agencies to determine the limits of congressional language or enactments. And so you don't get a federal agency to come in and say what constitutes an absence of good cause. That's up to the judge to determine.
Correct.
And then we would review that on an abuse of discretion type standard. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Final rule entry at the 81 Federal Register, that entry that we've been talking about from 2016, is that description of policy purpose and handling all the comments and all of that sort of thing. And as I read it, I couldn't help but notice that there is the author is reciting a number of statements about the department's superior position to interpret ICWA. It speaks of its entitlement to Chevron deference and probably no other way to describe it is perhaps a palpable distrust for state courts, who actually apply the provisions of
25 U.S.C. 1911. So do you agree that that's, I mean, that's not binding and perhaps even is further from, do you agree it's not binding?
I would agree that it is not binding and that state courts, in particular this court, are entitled to make their own judgments based on actual practice in South Dakota and in the circuit court's case, its intimate knowledge of the case when it's analyzing these provisions. Note that while we're talked extensively about the advanced stage analysis, we have not spoken much about the other analysis for good cause, which discusses the best interests of the children. And there, I would point out for this court's benefit that that is much more heavily fact dependent than the discussion of advanced stage has been thus far. And it's firmly within the circuit court's discretion and intimate knowledge of the case. The state respectfully asks this court to find that the circuit court did not abuse its discretion in this matter and affirm the circuit court's denial of transfer and termination of parental rights on the bases we've discussed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Levert. Ms. Landine, you may proceed with your argument.
Good morning. May it please the court. I do think that the 2016 regulations are binding. I think the Chevron was overruled by Loper-Bright. That's my takeaway from that. Chevron kind of puts these folks that put together the guidelines to take the place of the court, and that's not what's supposed to be. So I think this court can apply the regulation as it's written to affirm this case. I think the strongest
South Dakota. I don't understand your argument. You said that Loper-Bright overruled Chevron, which was the basis of the regulations, but yet you're saying the regulations are binding, or maybe I misheard you.
I think the regulations are binding. I don't think that the guidance is binding.
But what's the difference between the regulations and the CFRs? I mean, I guess I'm trying to understand what you're saying.
I think the court can apply 25 CFR 23118 without looking at the guidelines because I don't think that they control. I think the court can affirm.
So just are you saying we have the discretion to do that or whether we have to do that?
I think that the 2016 regulations are binding upon the court, and I think the court can affirm on that basis alone.
And they don't even seem to be, I mean, I don't know that anyone's got a big, as I understand the arguments, I don't know that anyone's got a big problem with, I don't know that we have to revisit that even. What really seems to be implicated in the briefs is, or maybe in our discussion today more, is not the guidelines themselves, but all of the stuff that's said with all of the agency remarks when they were reporting on the final action, which include the 2016 guidelines, as I read it, which by their own admission are not binding, even then.
But the fact that we're not bound by them doesn't mean that we can't consider them or find them persuasive or apply them if we choose to.
I would agree with that, yes.
So I'd like, can I
go ahead?
I'll kind of zero in on one of them, because it seems like one of the disputes between the parties here now in terms of the court's determination that there was good cause because of some specific things that related to what these children's needs were and how a transfer could potentially affect that. And then the opposition is, well, that runs afoul to one of these prohibitions in the federal rule, the one that refers to you can't consider negative perceptions of tribal or BIA social services. And so I'm wondering if you, you know, and that's, is there a difference between not considering a perception of the social services that would be available if there was a transfer and looking at evidence in the record with regard to what these particular children's needs are and more of a specific fact finding as to whether or not or how a transfer could potentially impact them depending on what services may be. I mean, that seems to be kind of one of the other main arguments here in the briefing before us.
The circuit court did sustain an objection when a question was asked regarding services that the tribe may or may not be able to provide. So the court didn't focus on that. What I do think the court did focus on is the permanency and the advanced stage of the hearing itself, with the actual notice that was given at the outset in October of 2024 and continued throughout with amended notice in November. And then,
makes an alternative finding that that's not in the best interest of the children. I think that's what Justice Devaney's asking about.
And my takeaway was that the court was looking at the stability and permanency for the children, which was outside of the 23.118.
So do you think services are out of bounds under the 25 CFR 23.118? Do you think that the court can't look at all at services that the tribe may have if there's transfer?
I mean, what I think is one thing and what the court did is another. I do think that those are things that the court could have made inquiry to or allowed up to a certain point, but not to the detriment of the tribe.
But does there need to be evidence that the tribe actually has no plan? In this case, you know, I think there was some consultation with the ICWA representative. No evidence put on as to what the tribe was planning, what their options were. The burden's ultimately on party resisting the transfer, right?
Yes.
So it doesn't seem like we have much evidence in this case in terms of what the tribe's plan was, and so then that seems to get back to this negative perception of, well, the tribe's not going to handle it right. Can you comment on that?
Being there present, there was a point where questions were wanting to be asked of the tribal representative, and that wasn't allowed by the court. And that's what drew the objection that was sustained by the court. So those things didn't get to go into. There was a comment made during a hearing where the tribe said, it was Evelyn Pilcher said, I don't know what we're going to do with these kids or something to that effect. But beyond that, that's where it went. And then other than what DSS testified to regarding the anxiety that the kids were having moving, you know, going forward into this transfer hearing and potential harm that may have caused. But
I think the other, can I follow up? I mean, the other thing, you know, you referenced, you think the court's alternative ruling was primarily based on permanency and stability. And then I go back to the record there as well, you know, that it also seemed like, you know, it was very not clear how that would be affected, because, you know, it seemed that there was some notion that, well, maybe they could stay in their existing placement. There's just, that hadn't been determined yet.
Yeah, there was no finding. I don't believe that it couldn't, you know, that it would cause a delay. We just don't know, and I think that was the testimony that was presented on that issue, if that makes sense, if that answers your question.
Let me ask a question.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry, are you done?
Yes, go ahead.
So in the policy purpose comments about 118 and these regulations that were promulgated in 2016, there is the statement that the mere passage of time alone can't justify denying transfer. And Justice Devaney was just asking sort of in a hitting on some of those things about stability and things like that. Our cases, though, hold generally that children at some point in a proceeding are entitled to finality and stability. And we recognize in a number of our cases precisely that the passage of time does provide a lack of stability for children, which they need. And so, for instance, a number of our cases will affirm in any, you know, several cases I can think of, a circuit court's decision to not grant a continuance, in favor of a guardianship, things like that. Do you see a conflict with a policy statement, which may be non-binding, that mere passage of time isn't sufficient to implicate either advanced stage or best interest, probably, let's just say best interest, in our cases, which seem to suggest the opposite?
Speaking from a practical standpoint, our cases in state court and DSS policy is we need to get these kids some permanency and stability within 12 months.
Because it's connected to their best interests.
Correct. And so I think that's where the state court is looking when they're talking about permanency and stability and moving the case to a final disposition in one way, shape, or form, whatever that might be.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You may proceed with rebuttal. And as you get into that, I'd like to have you talk and really focus a little bit on the alternative analysis the court made, best interests, and... You know, is it your view that the court can't consider services at all or can't consider the extent to which the child's best interest may be impacted by a transfer? What's your view?
Well, my view is that it's not that it's completely barred to discuss. I think there needs to be specific facts, though, and specific evidence geared toward or connected to the transfer itself.
So then the question becomes, how does that evidence come in? I think there was an objection in this case. I think the court had, and I don't know that the ICWA representative was ever put under oath or that anyone from the tribe was called. And it seemed like the DSS witness, the CPS worker that was involved, didn't really know what the tribe's plan was. And so we're left with this record of, we don't know. Maybe the tribe has a great plan. Maybe the tribe has no plan. We just don't know. But the burden's on the party resisting. So that's the struggle in this case. But talk a little bit about that from your perspective.
And I think both best interest rationales, the tribe not proving is what the court found, that they had fully vetted caregivers and services to meet the children's needs. The burden was on the party objecting to the transfer, and there was really no evidence of that. The children's or attorney would ask the caseworker, you know, do you know what's going to happen? No, I don't know what's going to happen after the transfer.
What was it? It seems like there was also a question about what if there wasn't a transfer, you know, how long or what, you know, what would that process look like
and
too?
Caseworker admitted, you know, even if this case were to go forward with the adoption process, that can take a really long time. And on the question of finality, caseworker was asked, will the transfer delay permanency for the children? She said, I don't think so. That's what we have for the evidence in this case. We don't have evidence that this was going to delay permanency. The motion to transfer was filed. It didn't push back the final dispositional hearing whatsoever. And so there's no indication that this wouldn't be a transfer of the case file from DSS to the tribe as required by regulation, and they would carry this work forward.
But isn't there an implication that if there's no plan, that would delay permanency?
Well, I think the...
I mean, isn't that a reasonable inference from...
I don't think in this case, because a tribal agent was familiar with the children's placement and they were in ICWA placements already, and the tribal agent even indicated that, you know, that this wouldn't necessarily change their placement. And so in that regard, if they're in...
I'm not talking about placement, I'm talking about permanency, about... completion
right.
of the case.
Well, and I think when we're talking about best interests, ICWA presumes that the tribe can serve the best interests of Indian children. And whether, you know, the tribal court maybe views some of those things in a different way, I don't think it's for the state court to inject the subjective values.
Well, but you know, you're right. I mean, I think that's a reasonable reading of ICWA, but ICWA then also says, hey, state court judge, you know, you can find the absence of good cause for a transfer. So it doesn't take that authority away. All I'm trying to get at is, isn't it up to the judge to determine whether or not there's an absence of good cause? Then we get to review it for an abuse of discretion.
And I think when you look at the record and what was put as testimony at this transfer hearing, you are not left with clear and convincing evidence that the transfer to the tribe is not in the best interests of children, and ICWA presumes the opposite.
When you distill this case to its essence, and just for our purposes of discussion, I understand there's regulations and binding and not binding, and I know there's cases and all that stuff, but when you put all of the ink that's been spilled on this topic to the side, the text of 1911B isn't that hard. The court, in the absence of good cause to the contrary, shall transfer such proceeding to the jurisdiction of the tribe. We do good cause all the time. You have to get a protective order under Rule 26. You have to have good cause. You need this. You need that. It's good cause. State courts can handle that. They can manage that. Why is that so hard, and why have we spilt all this ink as it relates to a standard that, by the way, doesn't say clear and convincing. It doesn't say someone's got a burden over someone else. It just says good cause.
And good cause must be proven by clear and convincing evidence. And here, we just simply don't have that. And it's not simply discretionary. There has to be something to rebut the presumption by clear and convincing evidence, and this just it just wasn't there in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.